Joseph Tarkovsky for Ranger Kevin Tice. I'll try to reserve 3 minutes. May it please the court, I think the place to start is with what this case does not involve. It does not involve any utterances by Mr. Green. It does not involve any retaliation against Mr. Green.
It doesn't involve any utterances.
I think it does not in this case, fortunately. It does not involve any unconstitutional conduct by the Nevada Highway Patrol with the one question of this prior restraint. This case involves a district court making the extraordinary finding that a 160-word email from a commanding officer to his employees could constitute...
Well, there are other similar cases.
We submit that there are not similar cases in which, in law enforcement context, telling your own employees they should observe the confidentiality policy. I don't think any...
This wasn't just the confidentiality policy, though. I mean, that's why we're here. I mean, this wasn't overbroad in terms of what the major was directing. I don't know that it's exactly what you say. I mean, in fact, I think that's where it probably should start.
Sure.
Is because if it was just, hey, we have a confidentiality policy, and then just the official duties, and I guess that's where we are, is was it too overbroad in light of the official duties and his ability as a public citizen to be able to speak out on things? So,
correct, Your Honor. So the question is there something about the character of this email, this directive, which we say is confidentiality, that brings it out of the realm of standard employee stuff and into the realm of prior restraint?
We said, Your Honor, what I don't understand is that you have this confidentiality policy in place, and it simply says that you shall treat the official business of the commission as confidential. Information regarding official business shall be disseminated only to those for whom it is intended in accordance with established procedures. Why is that not enough? That seems to cover the bullet point. What do you need more than that?
The commanding officers who sent the email were just concerned that it wasn't being followed. So they wanted, in their view, to reiterate this. We must.
Why didn't they just reiterate the confidentiality policy? It seems like they expanded it.
So what's it? So our position is that this, well, why is this the same thing? So both the policy you mentioned in this email, they're both getting at the same thing. So there's no magic word with respect to confidentiality. What the email says, it has a preface which the district court's order omitted, but which they're opening. It says, in order to ensure an appropriate flow of communication, which seems to me a very fine synonym for the concept of confidentiality. Confidentiality means information goes
to... All they have to do is repeat the confidentiality policy. All they have to do is say that, remember, we have a confidentiality policy. We want to urge you to comply with it.
They may have, but what is unconstitutional about phrasing it in a different way?
I don't know what it would mean. It really is a total gag order on people, you know, at the risk of discipline of saying things that would be permissible.
For example, this is the confidentiality provision, I assume, was meant to be understood to cover information. But this covers opinion, right? I mean, in other words, you can't say anything, including I don't like our canine policy, without even if you provide no information.
I would submit, Your Honor, that if you wanted to draft an email that reiterates a confidentiality policy that served that interest, restricting those restrictions.
But am I right that this means that you can't express an opinion about the canine policy if you're an employee of the department? Without divulging anything.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's how it would
be. That's what it says. It could be no contact with any non-departmental for the purpose of discussing the program.
The business of a canine unit is typically confidential. It says don't talk about our daily business outside of law enforcement channels.
Including, I think, what allows a canine policy.
Your Honor, I think that the way to look at this, if the inquiry is...
What's the answer to that? Just say that. You can't go to the newspaper and say, I can't tell you anything, but we really have a lousy canine policy.
No, I think you could say that.
Maybe you can't under this.
I think that any reasonable officer reading this would have understood that it is a language under this particular email would seem to be forbidden. No confidentiality policy would survive. If you took this email and you replaced canine and line officers with law clerks, and you replaced canine program and interdiction program with matters pending in chambers, I think you'd have exactly what every federal judge enforces with respect to their own law clerks. The Federal Judicial Center, for instance, publishes a law clerk manual. It says, do not talk about any confidential information outside of chambers. Now, that, could that be read to pretend, to say, a clerk can't go to the newspaper and say, I think this is a lousy case, the floor is bad, the judge is missing? No. Maybe you could, and maybe that sort of whistleblowing would have to be seen as some sort of implicit exception, but this is how confidentiality policies are always written. They don't say, I mean, if you wanted to read this so narrowly, yes, it could be read to say something like, you can't tell your kids where you work. You can't tell your bowling buddies that you have to work on a weekend. But confidentiality policies are always phrased in broad terms.
Do we look at this as written or in context? Because the context, as I understand it, was that there was a raging dispute and there were, people would understand it in terms of what was actually happening at the time.
That's true. I think, I mean, if you want to follow the Clark case in the Seventh Circuit, they said, look at the text. So in that case, the Seventh Circuit had found that the sheriff had retaliated. And they thought, this is the Clark case. This is the Milwaukee sheriff's office that the district court thought was the most significant case. The circuit has found that they said the sheriff acted childishly. So they had retaliation, but they said nothing in the text of this particular email directive talks about private citizen speech. You have the Clark email text, which is indistinguishable from this, but yet, nevertheless, it says, it is the policy that all sheriff's officers are keeping confidential, don't impart it to anyone. It doesn't say anything about, you can't say the sheriff is coming.
We're supposed to look at what, evaluate everything that they was not specifically prohibited, because I'm looking at the language and it says, it clearly states that no direct contact can be made with any unauthorized person. And then it goes on to say that any violation would be insubordination and will be dealt with appropriately. And so I guess we're back at the same, question is, how do those statements not bar Mr. Moonen's speech as a citizen and not just as an employee? I mean, I think we all understand that there are certain things as a public employee he would not be able to speak about, and where the confidentiality would be appropriate regarding his duties. But here, this was you said this is an extraordinary finding. Well, this seems to be an extraordinary statement that was sent out.
It seems to be, to me, I mean, having reviewed a number of these survey interviews, excuse me, I'm Mr. Garden Variety, I don't know how else you would phrase this. If you wanted to be.
Let's look at the policy in the Milwaukee case and compare it to this one. Right? It seems to me to be night and day, actually. In the sense that one is a keeping official business confidential, don't say anything about anything. About the policy, there's a difference between keeping things confidential and not expressing an opinion. Then it says that they should not impart to anyone except for those from whom it's intended the official business, and no member shall speak on behalf of the organization. It doesn't say nobody should speak, and it doesn't say nobody should express an opinion. It just says you should keep the business confidential and you shouldn't speak on behalf of the organization. So it says exactly what you're saying wistfully that their disagreement says, i.e., that it deals with official business and confidential information, but this one doesn't do that.
I think our email is superior to the Clark one. It's even more constitutionally sound because instead of using the phrase official agency business, which, by the way, is what the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office happens to use, but there's no significance constitutionally, instead of saying that, we said something more specific, which is the canine interdiction program. If that isn't a more specific version of official agency business, I don't know how you would phrase it. Like I say, I mean, you can find hypothetical things in which this would seem to say, well, that you can't protect that. That's not whistleblowing. But the way the law deals with those things is retaliation cases.
Can I suggest that maybe more productively you could talk about qualified immunity?
Sure. I'd be happy to. The district court based its qualified immunity, the strict major types of qualified immunity on the basis of a single case from out of circuit that has never been cited in this circuit, and then actually found handily for the law enforcement agency. The district court only found that this bar, this strict him of qualified immunity by implication, the district court used the phrase, but the ambit of the implication shows that this email, by contrast, is unconstitutional. That doesn't seem to be good enough to deprive him of qualified immunity in the Ninth Circuit. Let me just quickly address.
Well, I mean, the one thing that
this
policy
the official policy that it was from the 90s. You mean this email?
Yes.
Oh, it's February 2011.
I see.
Our setting point, which is our third point, is very simple, which is to say that the district court adapted the Pickering analysis. But Garcetti changed Pickering. Garcetti says, before you get to the balance, you have to ask in what capacity he's making the speech. You may feel that he was making a speech, or he would have made a speech in a private capacity, but the district court did not, decide the way we think is wrong, or made a finding as a matter of law, and should have taken some facts. The district court did not even consider it. That was the Darius Reed case, which wasn't Garcetti. That's right. I don't think Garcetti should apply, but the district court did apply Pickering in Garcetti. So if you're going to apply Garcetti, you have to apply all the factors of Garcetti, which the district court didn't do.
Mr. Tice testified, I guess, in his deposition that he never intended for the email to be used or interpreted or construed as an unconstitutional type of restraint or limit Mr. Moonen's ability to talk about things. I'm just trying to figure out what do we do with that after the fact sort of justification. At this point, I mean, can we consider that testimony? Tell me how that fits in here.
I think it just supports what we've been discussing, that you have to read this in context. I think you could look at the text, but if you want to the larger context, is of course the testimony from the officers and what they were trying to do. The Pickering analysis, again, requires you to look at what the motive of the law enforcement agency was in sending this. The district court said that's not relevant because it's a prior restraint. So the plaintiffs got their half of Pickering, and we didn't get our half of Pickering. Nevertheless, we have all four commanding officers responsible for this email, all testifying that, look, there was a series of leaks that were causing disruption, and we had a right and a duty to stop, and so we decided to send this email. That's what the purpose was.
Any case in all those talks about whether or not in the prior restraint case, motive and intent is a relevant factor, I haven't found one.
No, I don't think it is, but that's the problem, which is to say that this.
I thought you said it was, that's why you're relying on the evidence.
We took the position to brief that Pickering and Garcetti, it doesn't make sense to apply the prior restraint, but I'm taking the district court's order on its own terms. The district court applied Pickering.
Well, the term prior restraint is, I think, not helpful. But and one of the opinions says that because typically prior restraint law deals with judicial restraints, but what you have is a blanket policy, let's call it that, blanket policy. So let's take the prior restraint language out of this. Still, there are a number of cases, including in the Seventh Circuit, in which statements of policy of this kind have been in damages actions. I was surprised to find out that these are subject to damages actions, but there are a number of such cases are judged basically on their face, as I understand it. So that doesn't seem to be a question. The question is whether, for qualified immunity purposes, there's a case close enough to this one to put Tice on notice.
Right. Well, let me just make one last point about the Clark case. The Clark panel said that the central issue, that's their word, central, was that on the face of the scene, even though they knew that it was designed to get at constitutionally protected speech, the central issue was that nothing in this email would prohibit them from going outside of it. And I think that's the same thing here. Like I say, this is how confidentiality policies are written. They never say something like, keep information confidential, unless you feel very strongly that the newspaper needs to know about.
Well, that's why I asked the context question. We know, but it seems to me that in this instance, people reading it would have
his allegation is that he didn't, and he went.
Not whether he did it, but that what he was being accused of having done, he would understand that they were being told not to do what he was accused of having done.
Yes. But the only fair way, it seems, to adjudicate these sorts of issues is to let the complaining officers speak. Let's see what they say. And then let's see how the agency responds. And then we have a case, we have
the
witness.
Well, very easy to put a sentence at the end that said, we understand in some circumstances you have a constitutional right to say things, and we're not trying to override that, but you didn't say that.
But no confidentiality policy does. I mean, it's just her, that's just not how they're written. They're always very broad. And if he makes if he whistleblows, say that's what he wanted to do, and that's what he did. The thing about whistleblowing is you can do it, but you better be right about it. You can say a judge is lazy and incompetent and corrupt, but unless you have good evidence for that, that's not, I don't think the Constitution is going to protect you against discipline. And they thought misinformation was going out. They thought damaging leaks were occurring, and they acted. And this is, I think, I don't know how you could have phrased this email better. I think it's very nice.
That's what I pointed out to begin with. This thing is not talking about information as such, necessarily.
Talking about their day-to-day duties, the things they do as Canadian High and Line Officers, don't talk about your day-to-day duties.
It's, but it's not saying don't give information. They don't talk about it at all.
Outside of authorized channels without preclearance. You can't.
You're out of time.
You've been very patient. Thank you for letting me trespass.
Thanks for the argument.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Good morning. Still morning. Ken McKenna on behalf of Amanda and the plaintiff, appellee. It is the letter, the email. That's what this case is.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
It is a letter, an email form.
Right.
That is this case. It is the four corners. It does speak for itself. It is what it is. And all the appellant has tried to do throughout this case, both at the district court level, motion, re-motion, argument, briefing here and argument here today, is say the letter says something other than what it says.
Well, they say that motive and the intent and the underlying dynamics are relevant considerations. Do you know of any case that really supports that proposition?
I do not. In fact, the case law supports the opposite. You take the letter on its face for the content as to what the reader would have gotten having received this letter, not what the misstated intent was or the after the fact.
Well, the officers at that time, what the qualified immunity law was stated, I mean, what the voting intent should be something that can be considered.
There could be cases where that applies, but the overbroad nature of this communication, and I, and let me just say, I mean, you can look at the. At this point, correct.
Right. Has anybody asked what the possible damages are?
There have been discussions about what the damages should be or could be, and there's been communication back and forth in that regard, but there has not been a settlement.
I mean, it seems to me that without any adverse action taken, the damages are nominal $1 damages or something.
I would totally disagree with that, and I think the other side, based on their prior... The mediations that have occurred in this case.
Which is, are there actually any damages?
There are damages.
But still the issue, this whole prospective speech, I mean, with calling a prior restraint, I don't necessarily agree with that in light of what we understand prior restraint to be, the sort of, but it's kind of a limitation on prospective speech. I guess I'm just trying to figure out, how can we be sure that would have been his speech? And just trying to figure out if there's any case law out there that permits us to consider what he alleges his speech would have been.
I follow, but I'm not sure that's necessary to inquire as to what his speech would have been. He's being told, and we know the employee, citizen, public need to know, and public importance is the issue. In the initial analysis, before you even get to the Pickering analysis on the balance, is this something? Is he being told, as you stated, Your Honor, that he can't even have an opinion about conduct that's occurring at the Nevada Highway Patrol? Police officers, law enforcement officers who are conducting unconstitutional searches, breaking the law, and doing other conduct which obviously the public has to know, needs to know, and has a right to know, and that he's aware of this information and is being told, because it is in context of what's going on. There were five news stories about his canine program and the illegal activities. It's on videotape that officers are ripping open, poking holes in packages at the UPS depot so the dogs can smell better when the package comes by, so they can get a positive hit. It's on videotape, and it was on the news. So we know what it is that he's going to report. That's his opinion.
It all deals with his official duties and his job.
Not, I mean, the illegal conduct is certainly not part of his official duties. It's the opposite of his official duties. At that point, he is giving information that the public citizen.
Excuse me, it's couched, though, in the email, I guess, or maybe in the brief, that, you know, if there's any violation of any, you know, thing, rule, that's part of their official duties to report to their supervisor.
Certainly.
And so, you know, your counsel here across the aisle said, you know, this is why he's saying it's better, this statement was better than some of the other statements, because they were trying to limit it to his official duties. The way they styled it, and so I'm just curious, why isn't this some potential speech aligned with his official duties, and given that this is still at the summary judgment phase, is this something that would go to the jury to determine whether or not, you know, this is part of his official duties, because there does appear to be some overlap.
I would answer your question with a question. Read the email. No,
I
know. No, I understand. No,
that's why I'm asking the question.
No, in capitals. Use capitals. No direct contact. Any communication in capitals. Any non-departmental people in capitals. All communication is restricted.
Because the same thing about the supervisors. Not saying you can't do anything whatsoever. Same thing with the supervisors.
Well, that's what they want you to interpret, but it doesn't say talk to your supervisor. It says talk to your supervisors in addition to saying all, any, no, you will be punished. I mean, you're threatened with insubordination. That's termination.
Well, Mr. McKinnon?
Yes.
Does that overlap with official duties?
It does not overlap.
It's, so does it not when they're talking?
It's overbroad. It's beyond his official duties.
Now, that's my question. Is you don't think that part of overlapping means it is to deal with his official duties?
He has official duties as an officer and a canine head or et cetera, confidentiality of information within. But that's not what we're talking about. That's what they want to talk about. And they could have done that, but they didn't. They said you can't communicate with anybody about anything, and that includes a canine.
The problem is that even with regard to a more strange confidentiality policy, such as the other one here, or such as the one in the Milwaukee case, there are instances, I presume, in which a public employee might be constitutionally privileged to violate it, right?
I'm not sure if I caught the end of that one.
Might be constitutionally privileged to violate it. In other words, if you have a policy that says you cannot impart any information that you learn in your official capacity about the business of this agency, and it's limited information, it's limited to official communications, it still could be that if you learn in your official capacity that your boss is taking
guess that's why I was a little concerned about the official capacity element interlaced to the public duty, because they could be at the same time.
But that privilege would not invalidate the policy, would it?
No, of course not.
Even though you might violate it, I'd be protected.
Yes.
And I understand that that's really the argument on the other side of this. What they're saying is, well, you know, you have to have the courage of your convictions. If you believe that there is something that violates this policy, that you have a constitutional right to say, go ahead and say it and test that proposition. And what's wrong with that as an approach to a sensible world in which, yes, there is a confidentiality value with regard to any law enforcement and other professional organizations at the same time. And certainly there's contractual, there's the possibility of a contractual agreement that you're not going to say anything that goes on here. And the fact is that there may be constitutionally based exceptions to that.
Yes.
But that, policy on its face is not valid.
Well, it's not a policy. The policy is the confidentiality policy that they all live under. This is not, no, what this is. It's a letter saying we're going way beyond the confidentiality policy. You can't say anything to anybody under no circumstances about anything way beyond the confidentiality policy, way beyond the employee situation. As a public citizen with a public right and a public's need to know about improper, illegal conduct going on within the place that you work, even though you're law enforcement, you can't say anything about it.
Even too often, does the city have anything like that? It's not themselves to your supervisor for approval. You may have the chain of command and just simply says, don't go off and say this to anybody. Come to talk to us first. I mean, what's wrong with doing that? It doesn't say that there after you cannot say anything. It says first talk to us, and then we can sit down and chat about it.
Well, it says that in one sentence, but in the prior sentences, it says don't do it. It doesn't say come and get approval to do it. It says no communication, no direct contact, any policy, all communication. Then it says present it to somebody or ask permission.
And my understanding of what it says is present it for approval, and if it's approved, then communication will be accomplished by the appropriate manager or commander if deemed appropriate. In other words, not that you can say it, but they will say it if they think it's appropriate.
Well, you still tell you not to say it. For instance, you have an opinion.
He will tell you how to say it, then he will say it himself when he thinks it's appropriate.
Let me ask the question. If you had an opinion, you're this officer, and you have an opinion that...
I'm just going to answer the question, see if it's a friendly question. This was a friendly question.
Well, I understand it's a friendly question, and I know I'm going to run out of time, but, you know, we're all talking the same thing. We're kind of going around a little bit. But, yes, if an officer is aware of some illegal conduct, and he were to take it to a supervisor and say, I think this is a public concern. I want to make a general statement outside the agency that there's an illegal activity occurring. And the supervisor would say, oh, no, don't do that. And then he does it anyway. So would he be protected in the Constitution? Of course, it's basic stuff. Should we take a break? Okay. Stay seated. Kind of what you've seen already. I think the thing that obviously dealing with this case over the years and Judge Hicks' ruling and appreciate and understand it, I think the thing that concerned me the most this morning was when counsel said he considered this a garden variety letter. that this would be just garden variety. You can't talk to anybody anytime. I guess that concerns me more than even the incident in this specific case, that the state of Nevada, the representatives for the Highway Patrol, thinks that you can tell people you can't talk to anybody about anything at any time because we're the Highway Patrol and we will terminate you if you do, and your opinion or your constitutional rights are invalid, and they don't count because your employment is more restrictive than your right as a public citizen to speak out about injustice or wrongdoing. I'm a little shocked by that statement.
What doesn't count about this and about this whole area is that the employees have information they obtain because of their status as employees. And moreover, there is a managerial authority because of their status as employees on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a strong public interest in a way, it's a misportrayal to say they're speaking as citizens. They're speaking as citizens because of things they learned as employees. That's what makes their speech valuable and different. Now, in some instances, it might be other ways. They may just be speaking directly as citizens about things that have nothing to do with their employment. I think that was where the original cases came from, like Pickering and so on. But as time has gone on, it's really been more like whistleblowers. And so the adjustment is quite close, and that leads to the qualified immunity question, i.e., at what point, I mean, given the fact that there is a fair amount of room for employer control here, but at some point there isn't, was there sufficient notice?
And I think that is so well taken, because when we consider our society, and we certainly consider law enforcement uniquely, it is such a closed system that how else would the public get information about the internal...
Quick, because you know you're out of time, but I'd still like to hear you tell me what cases put Mr. Tice on notice that this was an unconstitutional directive.
And I think that Judge Hicks covers that in detail, and he goes to just, again, the four corners of the email itself and its overbroadness, and then he makes the statement that any reasonable law enforcement supervisor would know that this is overbroad and beyond confidentiality, beyond the employer-employee restrictions that you could expect. And again, I would... It struck me every time I looked at this email and I put yellow highlights on it. There's a thing now in Twitter and texting. If you use capital letters, you're yelling. If you text somebody and you use capital letters, you're yelling. So he's yelling the word no. He's yelling the word any communication. He's yelling the word any non-departmental people. He's yelling that you will be punished. I mean, this is extreme.
Right. Let me go back to my question.
Sure.
If the problem is that now the Supreme Court is taking an increasingly rigorous view of qualified immunity in terms of what case would have given you this notice, the judge begins to really cite any case, does he?
I think he takes the cases, the Garcia and Garcetti, Pinkring case, and I think he discusses it in quite a bit of detail, and he seems to focus on those key words again, and they happen to be the words that are capitalized. Any, all, any non-departmental will be punished in subordination. Again, this is an extreme email, and to say it's garden variety, as I said, is probably the most concerning thing I heard today. If this is normal, and this kind of communication can go out to employees that they can't talk to anybody about anything at any time, then we have no First Amendment right.
Let me ask you this, you're Pickering balancing.
Yes.
It has to be engaged in, correct?
Correct.
And I'm just curious as to how that really plays out in the context of qualified immunity, because Pickering balancing deals with, of course, an interest weighing against those other things. Does that sort of suggest that qualified immunity should be looked at very carefully when you deal with a Pickering balancing case? And do you have any Pickering balancing case which says that there is no qualified immunity?
actually flip that the other way. Justify what you did with qualified immunity. Don't make my client say it's not qualified immunity. How does he say he has qualified immunity when he writes an email that is so overbroad, so in violation of the First Amendment, so in contrast to the public's need to know, so the opposite of someone being able to exercise their opinions and their rights under the First Amendment? How does he say, I didn't know that violated someone's Just to hear my argument, Your Honor, I'm very excited to have been here.
But, you know, I'm just curious about that. I mean, because I assume that my law firm's can't say anything bad about Judge Watt's behavior, right?
Unless you took a bribe and they were a witness to it. Okay, that's what we're talking about. That's the difference. It's not employment. It's not confidentiality. It's not talking about somebody's personal habits. We're talking about illegal conduct by law enforcement. It's very much a public interest issue.
The official policy, I think, and I think it's been reviewed by the suggests that we tell our law clerks not to go on social media and say anything about the court, including it's a good court or a bad court or Judge so-and-so is a good judge or Judge so-and-so is a bad judge while they're law clerks.
I'm sure you can suggest that. I'm sure they can respect that. However, I don't know if they did it, that you would have a right to say they don't have a constitutional right to do what they have a right to do under the First Amendment, which is express their opinions. And again, we're beyond opinions and who's a good guy, who's bad. We're talking illegal activity. This is not just someone talking out of school about someone's, you know, drinking habits or personal habits in the office. We're talking about police officers committing illegal activity, and this letter trying to suppress an officer from bringing that to the public's attention.
Well,
thank you for allowing me.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the indulgence. I really do. Quick point. This talk about unconstitutional activity, this is an allegation in their complaint that they never proved. After years of discovery, this unconstitutional conduct, he said it, but it's not true. The point about the whistleblowing, the point about opinion, can you say this thing? I think that a court, just like law enforcement agency, has the power to restrain speech that calls the court or the agency into disrepute. You can go around and say, officers committing unconstitutional conduct left and right, because it's not true. They can act on that. That's the Supreme Court has said that in the San Diego versus Roe case. You don't have a right to badmouth an agency if you can't prove it. Same thing with your law clerks. Now, if your law clerks say, well, my judge has never read a single brief in his or her life, if that's not true, then you don't have a First Amendment right to say those types of things. You don't have a First Amendment right to slander, to spread mistruths. And in this case, doing this is...
That just colors the discussion. The question is not whether you have the right to spread mistruths. The question is whether you have the right to spread truths.
Well, I would say yes. I would concede that you have a First Amendment right to expose unconstitutional conduct by law enforcement agency. In this case, he alleged it, but they never proved it. It was just unfounded allegations.
For your question, the fact that we're having this rigorous discussion, does that not suggest that qualified immunity should attach in this particular case?
I think it suggests that qualified immunity should not attach in this case. I mean, if qualified immunity means...
Should it attach?
The point of qualified immunity, obviously, is every officer has to know this. If every officer knew this, do you think there would be, in the hundreds and hundreds of cases in which a law enforcement officer complains about something his or her department did to him or her, there's never been a case saying that something like this constitutes a presumptively unconstitutional prior restraint? Yes, I think there's an absence of authority for stripping him of qualified immunity.
The problem, of course, is that the next time somebody writes a policy, it's going to be a slip. And even assuming
qualified immunity thing is that it just chips away at the legitimate powers of law enforcement agencies to regulate the flow of information.
You think you'd rather win on the merits?
I would rather win on the merits, Your Honor. And I just would ask, just to consider, just because of my last point, that if you have in your mind an instance where the guy is whistleblowing about actual constitutional conduct, okay, that's a classic case where he would be protected. But that was allegated. It was an unproven allegation in this case. You do not have a First Amendment right to go say whatever you want about a law enforcement agency. It brings it into disrepute. I know we don't like to talk about these things as sort of a valid interest, but this court in Dibble versus Chandler, the Supreme Court in San Diego versus Rome, has said that a law enforcement agency has a valid interest in ensuring that the public understands fairly what it is they do and what it is they don't do, because it's very hard to have a law enforcement agency when the public doesn't trust it. The Supreme Court said that mistruths about law enforcement agency impair their mission